This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon and his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 20, Archaeology of the Great 8th Century.
Okay, we've covered most of the Iron Age, but I want to now focus on a very influential and important century of the Iron Age. We kind of went through it briefly, but we're going to look at it in depth in this video lecture. And that is the 8th century BC. And this is called by archaeologists the Iron Age 2B. And that's roughly the dates there. The first date is my date, but most scholars will say around 800 to 701. I make it 792 because that's the change from Amaziah to Uzziah as a result of the defeat at Beit Shemesh, and Amaziah being taken as a prisoner of war to Samaria. Many people call it the Great 8th Century, and foremost among those was the late scholar Philip King, who gave the SBL President Address way back in the 1980s and published that in JBL, The 8th, the Greatest of Centuries. And there's an argument definitely that could be correct. What's going on in the 8th century? It's a very tumultuous century, and it begins with the resurgence of both the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, Israel and Judah. And from about 790 to 740, both kingdoms become very, very strong and flex their muscles and expand both politically, their political borders, and their economic strength. This was really, in some ways, a second golden age following the united monarchy of Israelite and Judahite culture and society. And these are noted and critiqued in some of the prophets, notably Hosea, Amos, and the important passage in Isaiah 5. Now, after 740, everything changes. The Assyrians begin to flex their muscles, and rumblings to the east in Mesopotamia as Tiglath-Pileser III begins to advance and ultimately conquers Galilee and makes the northern kingdom almost a small rump state after his advance into the Levant. And the century ends with Sennacherib's invasion and just the devastation throughout the kingdom of Judah and the small regional kingdoms, again, submitting as vassals to this Assyrian king with great loss of life and just a tremendous destruction and then deportation of so many people. So it's a very, very eventful century, but also for biblical history a very important century because of the prophetic voices that we hear and the political events, both good and bad, that occurred. First of all, I want to look at the geopolitical context of this century. And first we look at Egypt. Again, Egypt is still in this third intermediate period, so it has it's fragmented and under weak control between the 23rd and 25th dynasties. K.A. Kitchen, a noted Egyptologist and an expert on the third intermediate period, notes this in his famous work by the same title. And Egypt simply did not play a major role in international affairs until the 26th or Sate dynasty in the late 7th century BC. So you see, because of the weakness of Egypt during this time, that allowed these regional kingdoms for a short, brief window to become strong and to exert their own influence. And that is exactly what Israel and Judah did. The other great power, which is a Mesopotamian power of Assyria, was also began the century quite weak. And again, regional conflicts and weak leadership during the first half of the century confined Assyria to Mesopotamia, northern Mesopotamia, and in some cases to the confines of Nineveh itself. And it was only during the reign, as we've seen before, of Tiglath-Pileser III, who came to the throne in the second or third quarter of the 8th century, that Assyria reasserted itself as a world global empire. And it reasserted itself, it did. Now, the expert here is D.J. Wiseman and Haim Tadmor. Wiseman is pictured here. Haim Tadmor's important work on the inscriptions of Tiglath-Pileser III. And some of the other works here that are listed, Grayson and others. We have a lot of Assyrian records. The records of Tiglath-Pileser were muddled and confused and fragmentary, but Tadmor and his disciples have collected those together brilliantly. Here's a list of 8th century Assyrian kings, some which we know very little about until Tiglath-Pileser, and then these are definitely on the radar, biblically speaking, because of what they did in the land of Israel. Tiglath-Pileser, again, conquered most of Galilee, northern Israel. Shalmaneser III and Sargon completed the destruction of the northern kingdom, and then Sennacherib devastated the southern kingdom, although Jerusalem was spared. And you can see their dates as well. And this is a picture of Assyria at its heights. It's actually later than the 8th century. The 7th century, where Upper and Lower Egypt are also under Assyrian control. So at its height, the Assyrians were very, very powerful, including conquering much of Urartu and into Asia Minor. Biblical context of the 8th century, we see the prophets and the historical works, Kings and Chronicles, of course, Jonah, again, an early 8th century context for the book of Jonah, where he goes and preaches to Nineveh. Amos, again a Judahite that goes and preaches, gives oracles against Israel and the other nations at Bethel. Hosea, northern prophet, who God tells to marry a prostitute to live an example of how Israel has treated God. And then, of course, the great prophet Isaiah, possibly a member of the Davidic family, a court prophet in the Jerusalem palace, and a brilliant writer. And his first half of his prophecy, again, reflects the circumstances of the late 8th century. And then finally, Micah, a prophet of the people in western Judah in the Shephelah, again, make up the last of these prophets, which give a lot of insight to what's going on in the kingdom, or these kingdoms, I should say, during this very interesting century. Joel and Obadiah, those dates are uncertain and probably later, so not included here in this list. Now, the 8th century begins on a very bad note. Amaziah is campaigning in Edom, the king of Judah, and has Israelite mercenaries with him. He dismisses those mercenaries who are angry for not being paid, not being followed through with their contract, and so they ravish some of the towns of Judah. Amaziah then Jehoash of Israel exchange words, which are recorded, unpleasantries, I should say, and the two face off. The two armies, the armies of Israel and Judah, face off at Beit Shemesh in the Shephelah and in the Sorek Valley. And Judah is defeated. More than that, Judah is ravaged by the army of Jehoash, and Jerusalem itself is sacked. And the walls of Jerusalem are knocked down. And the term here is kind of broken down or pushed down by the Israelite army. So this is bad, obviously, for Judah. Amaziah is taken as a hostage and taken back to Samaria. So his son, with advisors, of course, Uzziah, takes over the kingship of Judah. Interestingly enough, the Beit Shemesh that arises out of this battle is unfortified. And that, I think, speaks pointedly to the fact that later on in the century, Judah expanded and was this was no longer a border city as it had been for a number of years, a number of a long length of time. More than that is that when Uzziah takes over and Amaziah is removed from the kingship because he's a hostage, this is interesting, an interesting coincidence, because you have a destruction layer at the site and you've got a change in kings the same instant, the same exact event. So you can correlate a destruction layer with a session of a new king. And that, due to, with Thiele's help, Edwin Thiele's help, who wrote the Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings, we can point to a very precise date for the beginning of the Iron 2B, which I put at 792, which is when this event took place. And this is what we talk about, what I just mentioned. This is an overview of Beit Shemesh with the modern excavations done by Tel Aviv University. And the fact that these two events correlate, a change of king and a destruction layer, make an ideal bookmark or line to change from Iron 2A to Iron 2B. I want to spend some time talking about a very very well-known site in the archaeological literature, in the biblical literature, and that site is Kuntilat Ashrud. We mentioned it earlier. And Kuntilat Ashrud is a very isolated site in eastern Sinai. You can see the map here with it. And it's just over on the Egyptian side of the Sinai border with Israel. But again, during the 1970s, Israel had control over Sinai. And so they sent various expeditions out to do surveys to look at the archaeological remains of this very barren region. And one of those researchers was Ze'ev Meshel. And he did excavations at a very isolated fort. You could call it a fort. That's even contested and debated. And they found out through these excavations in the mid-70s that this isolated fort, walled structure, was only occupied for a very short period of time, the late 9th, early 8th century BC. More than that, the pottery assemblage from this fort had a mixture of northern Israelite forms and Judahite forms, as well as other forms from the coast and perhaps even from Egypt, if I remember right. There was superb preservation of small finds and the remains here, and it was very important. What was found was very, very important to understanding the history of these two kingdoms. Now, 95 to 99% of the focus on this site are inscriptions written on storage jars or pithoi that were found in the inner gate chamber. But these will really, in my opinion, are secondary in importance. Now, these inscriptions were epitaphs or prayers, and they included the terms Yahweh of Samaria and his Asherah. And, of course, we saw those before at Kirbet El Kom, and this seems to indicate a syncretistic view of God, a mixture of Canaanite and Yahwistic faith. And the script here and the orthography seem to be northern. So what you got here is northern Israelite garrison serving apparently with a Judahite garrison on the border of Egypt. And we'll unpack this more when we specifically talk about Uzziah, the reign of Uzziah. But the sensational literature about the God and his wife, God and his Canaanite wife, is really secondary in nature, in my opinion, to the fact of the geopolitical implications of this site that seems to be jointly garrisoned by Judahites and Israelites on the Egyptian border. We'll talk more about that later. The reign of Jeroboam of Israel was very prosperous. Again, he was part of the Jehu dynasty, and he was able to expand the borders of the Northern Kingdom, including parts of Transjordan, up into Syria, up into the Aramean Damascus area. And but the Bible is the Book of Kings is very, very brief on their description of his reign. You got terms like Lebo Hamat, which might mean the entrance to Hamat or an actual site. But they were clearly prosperous years under his long reign. This, again, of course, is a model of Megiddo that depicts Megiddo during the early 8th century. We've already talked about the seal of Shammah, servant of Jeroboam, most definitely Jeroboam II, and the ivories of Samaria. These all date to his reign. And so it was a very important reign, but at the same time, very little known about it. Now, we'll have a special PowerPoint lecture on Uzziah, but he was also very, very successful during this time. The king of Judah, who took over when Amaziah was taken hostage, and had a long 52-year reign with much success. Then things started falling apart, and the first king to reign after Uzziah was his son Jotham, and he had seemingly a reign that continued the success of his father, but he was followed by Ahaz, who was a weak king, and it was during his reign that the Philistines began to invade Judah from the west, the old nemesis way back from the United Monarchy and before. Now began to rear their ugly head and took over part of the western Shephelah. More than that, Ahaz was very close to the Assyrians and became a vassal of Tiglath-Pileser and wanted Assyrian help against pressure from other regional kingdoms to resist Assyria, and that started a war called the Syro-Ephraimite War, which is mentioned in Isaiah 7. And so instead of when Isaiah says, trust in the Lord and don't trust in the Assyrians or anybody else, Ahaz weakens and goes to Assyria for help. Now there's a later text in 2 Kings 20 and Isaiah 38 where there's a term called the Dial of Ahaz. And this is a term that is used during Hezekiah's reign. And it is believed by Yadin and others to represent some sort of a sundial that were two flights of stairs joining at the top. This is kind of an artist's reconstruction of what it may have looked like to tell time. And perhaps Ahaz found this or discovered this when he visited Damascus and saw the beautiful Assyrian altar that he wanted to copy in Jerusalem. May have seen this as well, and so built this large sundial, I guess you could call it, for his palace. And of course, that was mentioned later in a later context during the reign of Hezekiah. We have actually a bole or a seal impression with the name of Ahaz on it, and again is a picture of late Philistine ware, Ashdod ware. From that time that the Philistines were using when they invaded Judah. Fall of Israel took place in the 8th century, and you've got the Assyrian king Shalmaneser V, Sargon II, finally destroying this great city of Samaria, which was probably in some ways larger and more impressive than Jerusalem itself. And again, all of the population is deported after this long siege, and the Northern Kingdom is no more. And Tiglath-Pileser's successors, these two kings, Shalmaneser and Sargon, import peoples from the northern provinces of Assyria into the land to replace the people they deported. And hence we have the beginning of the Samaritans, these so-called half-breeds of people that inhabit to northern Israel after the fall of Samaria. Now during the 8th century, Jerusalem also experienced exponential growth, And as we've seen before, the city of David, up through the reign of David, was the core of Jerusalem. This was the city of Jerusalem, a hot dog-shaped eastern hill that was fortified and built up upon. Solomon extended that, including the Ophel and the Temple Mount, Mount Moriah. But in the 8th century, and I believe early in the 8th century, perhaps even in the late 9th century, you've got extramural suburbs here on the western hill. Much better real estate, by the way, here than here. But they finally fortified it with a wall. And the wall that Jehoash destroyed in Jerusalem, it's difficult to... they describe the length and the number of towers. It has to have been a wall that encompassed the western hill. So it might have been a wall that was under construction or a wall that had recently been erected. And Jehoash, again, burst through that and took it down. So Uzziah and his successors had to rebuild that wall. And that encompassed a huge new area and expanded Jerusalem immensely when it covered the western hill and the hill, which is now the Armenian quarter of the old city. So you see again the progression here of these small graphs of a small city, David, Solomon, Solomonic extension, and then the later monarchy that enclosed the western hill. But then, in the Persian period, after the fall, when fall of the kingdom in 586, when the deportees came back, they rebuilt Jerusalem, but only this area of Jerusalem. And we'll talk about that when we talk about Nehemiah chapter 3. The reign of Hezekiah, one of the most famous kings of Judah, was again eventful. And Hezekiah was a vassal, a minimal vassal of Assyria, but at the same time was building up his military, building up his supplies, fortifying his cities, and we believe excavating a water channel, now called Hezekiah's Tunnel, and now also debated whether Hezekiah actually built this. It could have been done earlier. He certainly did part of it, according to 2 Chronicles 32, but he brought water from the Gihon Spring outside of the city into the city, to the Siloam Pool, so the people of the western hill and the city of David could get water without going outside the wall. And that was a tremendous engineering feat because it was a serpentine-shaped tunnel that, engineers still are trying to figure out exactly how they did it. They could have been following a crack in the rock that was leaking water or something else, but they were able to follow the water. Two different groups of workmen working from opposite ends somehow met in the middle. And the important inscription found relating to this was a Siloam inscription found in the 1880s, actually by Arab children playing in the water there. And that was cut out of the rock and sent to Istanbul, where it remains today. But it's an unfinished inscription. It's the longest monumental inscription in Judah, but it's unfinished. And it describes, again, the workmen coming at from opposite ends and meeting and hearing each other's voices and noise through the rock and meeting, and the tunnels are joined, and water flows from the Gihon to the Siloam Pool. Now, there's also sluice gates, the Siloam Channel along the eastern side of the city of David, which watered gardens, and this may date back to Solomon to water his royal gardens in the Kidron Valley. So the chronicler in particular notes that Hezekiah fortified Jerusalem, the cities of Judah, amassed large amounts of supplies in preparation for a revolt that he was planning against Assyria. He also entertained Merodach-Baladan, or emissaries from that Babylonian ruler, to coordinate his revolt with other forces. And of course, this is the height of the use of the royal or lamellic jars of Judah, which we see another stamped handle there as well. Now, at a very, very important moment in 705, Sargon II dies in battle in Iran. And this is a very bad omen for Assyria when you have a king that dies in battle and they apparently were not able to even recover the body. And so, again, Assyria being such a hated empire because of what it does, vassals around the empire saw it as a weakness, that this is a weakness, that Assyria is in decline, and so everybody revolted. And Hezekiah formulated and got all the regional kingdoms around Judah to join in this revolt. All was not well, though, because Sennacherib amassed a huge army and began to put down this rebellion. And in 701, he appeared from the north, coming from the north towards the southern Levant. And it was at that time that Hezekiah's allies, the Transjordanian kingdoms, the Philistines, and the Phoenician kingdoms all ran up to Sennacherib and offered tribute and surrendered. So Hezekiah was essentially left in revolt. And so Sennacherib came with his huge army and systematically conquered and destroyed the cities of Judah, again, culminating with Lachish, which we had talked about earlier. Then he came to Jerusalem and surrounded the city, waiting for the final prize to take the Jerusalem, the capital city of Judah, the great city of Jerusalem. And of course, we know that the biblical account shows that, or tells us that, the angel of the Lord again destroyed the entire army. Sennacherib went home without an army and was eventually murdered by his own sons. Now there is, again, as we mentioned before, a huge amount of evidence and destruction layers throughout the kingdom of Judah that are attributed to this campaign of Sennacherib. It's a very strong red letter date in the archaeology of the Bible. Now, what we see here is a recently discovered seal with the name Hezekiah, king of Judah, Melech Yehuda, here on the bottom. And so that's a personal seal. We have several copies of this. We talked about the Bethlehem seal impression, possibly dating from this time. But what we haven't talked about yet is this tomb inscription that was discovered by Charles Clermont Ganeau in Silwan, that Arab village just opposite of the city of David across the Kidron Valley. Silwan was the necropolis or one of Jerusalem's cemeteries in the Old Testament. And many of the houses there today have back rooms that are actually tomb chambers carved in the rock. And so Clermont Ganeau was looking and studying all the tombs over there in the 1870s, 1880s about, and found this inscription. And he recognized it as an inscription, but he couldn't read it. It was in such weathered, battered shape. You can see the damage here, this hole cut possibly for a roof beam. But he noted it and left it in situ. But later on, it was cut out and shipped to the British Museum. And it was when it was at the British Museum that a young Israeli scholar by the name of Nachman Avigad in the 1950s restudied this and was able to decipher the text. And it says, this is the tomb of Shibna Yahu, or Yahu. We don't have the first part of the name because of this hole here cut. Who is over the house? This is a term, Hebrew tomb for royal steward. There is nothing here but his body and the body of his slave wife. Cursed be the man who opens this tomb. And this tells us a lot. First of all, the person who is a royal steward with the Yahwistic name Yahu, or Yah at the end, has to be at the time of Hezekiah, Shibna Yahu. And Isaiah, in chapter 22, even comments about this exact person and may have been standing in on the city David and pointing to his tomb when he was commenting about the royal steward. So, and this also tells us too that the typical Judean could read, they were literate, because it warns people to stay away from the tomb and not to open it. Very, very important find, an incredible accomplishment by Avigad at that early stage of his career to actually decipher that and read that inscription. Sennacherib's invasion of Judah, again, is documented in these prisms, one of which we have here at the Horn Museum, a copy. Very important, and of course, a lot of, with all the three biblical texts, Isaiah, Kings, and Chronicles, all document this invasion, as well as Sennacherib himself. So you've got two different versions, biblical version and an Assyrian version, but there's still a tremendous amount of questions about exactly what happened and how things occurred. And we talked about in an earlier slide presentation the fall of Lachish. This is Lachish at the eve of Sennacherib's invasion. And again, these Lachish reliefs that show the Assyrian siege machinery, conquest, and the deportation of Lachish's residents. And Byron's poem again. And again, these points that I point at, that I have here, kind of the ultimate fate of what happened during Sennacherib's invasion. No destruction layer in Jerusalem, which again supports the miraculous event recorded in the Old Testament. The only destruction layer in Jerusalem is the Babylonian destruction of 586 by Nebuchadnezzar. Nothing earlier that has been found. 185,000 Assyrians die outside the walls of Jerusalem. And it's interesting that Herodotus, the much later Greek historian, gives kind of a cryptic account of a plague that affected Assyrian troops in the region. And that could be a memory of this event, biblical event here. Sennacherib's inscriptions and reliefs strongly imply, if not admit, that Jerusalem was not conquered. And the fact that Assyria would do such a step-by-step systematic destruction of a kingdom and leave the capital untouched tells us that some dramatic event had to have happened and just leave. So Judah and Hezekiah survive, but the kingdom is devastated and later becomes an Assyrian vassal state during the reign of Manasseh. And of course, the rise of the royal Zion theology is the final point, which is a false theology that God would never leave Jerusalem. Jerusalem cannot be conquered because God resides there. And that is unfortunately later found out to be false. Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon and his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 20, Archaeology of the Great 8th Century.